Chapter 10. They walked on, for some time, through the most crowded and densely inhabited part of the town, and then, striking down a narrow street more dirty and miserable than any they had yet passed through, paused to look for the house which was the object of their search. The houses on either side were high and large, but very old, and tenanted by people of the poorest class. As their neglected appearance would have sufficiently denoted, without the concurrent testimony afforded by the squalid looks of the few men and women who, with folded arms and bodies half doubled, occasionally skulked along. A great many of the tenements had shop fronts, but these were fast closed and mouldering away, only the upper rooms being inhabited. Some houses which had become insecure from age and decay were prevented from falling into the street by huge beams of wood reared against the walls and firmly planted in the road. But even these crazy dens seemed to have been selected as the nightly haunts of some houseless wretches, for many of the rough boards which supplied the place of door and window were wrenched from their positions to afford an aperture wide enough for the passage of a human body. The kennel was stagnant and filthy. The very rats, which here and there lay putrefying in its rottenness, were hideous with famine. There was neither knocker nor bell handle at the open door, where Oliver and his master stopped. So, groping his way cautiously through the dark passage, and bidding Oliver keep close to him, and not be afraid, the undertaker mounted to the top of the first flight of stairs. Stumbling against a door on the landing, he rapped at it with his knuckles. It was opened by a young girl of 13 or 14. The undertaker at once saw enough of what the room contained to know it was the apartment to which he had been directed. He stepped in. Oliver followed him. There was no fire in the room, but a man was crouching, mechanically, over the empty stove. An old woman who had drawn the low stool to the cold hearth and was sitting beside him. There were some ragged children in another corner, and in a small recess opposite the door there lay upon the ground something covered with an old blanket. Oliver shuddered as he cast his eyes toward the place and crept involuntarily closer to his master, for though it was covered up, the boy felt that it was a corpse. The man's face was thin and very pale, his hair and beard were grizzly, his eyes were bloodshot. The old woman's face was wrinkled, her two remaining teeth protruded over her under lip, and her eyes were bright and piercing. Oliver was afraid to look at either her or the man. They seemed so like the rats he had seen outside. "Nobody shall go near her," apostrophe said the man, starting fiercely up, as the undertaker approached the recess. "Keep back. Damn you, keep back, if you've a life to lose. Apostrophe, apostrophe, nonsense, my good man," apostrophe said the undertaker, who was pretty well used to misery in all its shapes. "Nonsense. Apostrophe, I tell you," apostrophe said the man, clenching his hands and stamping furiously on the floor. "I tell you, I won't have her put into the ground. She couldn't rest there. The worms would worry her not either, she is so worn away." Apostrophe, the undertaker offered no reply to this raving, but producing a tape from his pocket, knelt down for a moment by the side of the body. "Ah!" Apostrophe, apostrophe said the man, bursting into tears, and sinking on his knees at the feet of the dead woman. "Kneel down, kneel down, kneel round her, every one of you, and mark my words. I say she was starved to death. I never knew how bad she was, till the fever came upon her, and then her bones were starting through the skin. There was neither fire nor candle, she died in the dark, in the dark. She couldn't even see her children's faces, though we heard her gasping out their names. I begged for her in the streets, and they sent me to prison. When I came back, she was dying, and all the blood in my heart has dried up, for they starved her to death. I swear it before the gods that saw it. They starved her." Apostrophe, apostrophe, he twined his hands in his hair, and, with a loud scream, rolled groveling upon the floor. his eyes fixed, and the foam covering his lips. The terrified children cried bitterly, but the old woman, who had hitherto remained as quiet as if she had been wholly deaf to all that passed, menaced them into silence. Having unloosened the cravat of the man who still remained extended on the ground, she tottered towards the undertaker. "She was my daughter," said the old woman, nodding her head in the direction of the corpse, and speaking with an idiotic leer, more ghastly than even the presence of death in such a place. "Lord, Lord! Well, it is strange that I who gave birth to her, and was a woman then, should be alive and merry now, and she lying there, so cold and stiff. Lord, Lord! To think of it, it's as good as a play, as good as a play!" As the wretched creature mumbled and chuckled in her hideous merriment, the undertaker turned to go away. "Stop, stop!" said the old woman in a loud whisper. "Will she be buried tomorrow, or next day, or tonight? I laid her out, and I must walk, you know. Send me a large cloak. A good warm one. For it is bitter cold. We should have cake and wine too, before we go. Never mind. Send some bread, only a loaf of bread and a cup of water. Shall we have some bread, dear?" She said eagerly, catching at the undertaker's coat as he once more moved towards the door. "Yes, yes," said the undertaker, "of course. Anything you like." He disengaged himself from the old woman's grasp, and, drawing Oliver after him, hurried away. The next day, the family, having been meanwhile relieved with a half-quartern loaf and a piece of cheese, left with them by Mr. Bumble himself, Oliver and his master returned to the miserable abode, where Mr. Bumble had already arrived, accompanied by four men from the workhouse, who were to act as bearers. An old black cloak had been thrown over the rags of the old woman and the man, and the bear coffin, having been screwed down, was hoisted on the shoulders of the bearers and carried into the street. "Now, you must put your best leg foremost, old lady," whispered Sowerberry in the old woman's ear. "We are rather late, and it won't do to keep the clergyman waiting. Move on, my men, as quick as you like." Thus directed, the bearers trotted on under their light burden, and the two mourners kept as near them as they could. Mr. Bumble and Sowerberry walked at a good smart pace in front, and Oliver, whose legs were not so long as his master's, ran by the side. There was not so great a necessity for hurrying as Mr. Sowerberry had anticipated, however, for when they reached the obscure corner of the churchyard in which the nettles grew, and where the parish graves were made, the clergyman had not arrived, and the clerk, who was sitting by the vestry room fire, seemed to think it by no means improbable that it might be an hour or so before he came. So, they put the bier on the brink of the grave, and the two mourners waited patiently in the damp clay, with a cold rain drizzling down, while the ragged boys whom the spectacle had attracted into the churchyard played a noisy game of hide and seek among the tombstones, or varied their amusements by jumping backwards and forwards over the coffin. Mr. Sowerberry and Bumble, being personal friends of the clerk, sat by the fire with him and read the paper. At length, after a lapse of something more than an hour, Mr. Bumble, and Sowerberry, and the clerk, were seen running towards the grave. Immediately afterwards, the clergyman appeared, putting on his surplice as he came along. Mr. Bumble then thrashed a boy or two, to keep up appearances, and the reverend gentleman, having read as much of the burial service as could be compressed into 4 minutes, gave his surplice to the clerk, and walked away again. "Now, Bill," said Sowerberry to the gravedigger, "fill up." It was no very difficult task, for the grave was so full that the uppermost coffin was within a few feet of the surface. The gravedigger shoveled in the earth, stamped it loosely down with his feet, shouldered his spade, and walked off, followed by the boys, who murmured very loud complaints at the fun being over so soon. "Come, my good fellow," said Bumble, tapping the man on the back. "They want to shut up the yard." The man, who had never once moved since he had taken his station by the graveside, started, raised his head, stared at the person who had addressed him, walked forward for a few paces, and fell down in a swoon. The crazy old woman was too much occupied in bewailing the loss of her cloak, which the undertaker had taken off, to pay him any attention, so they threw a can of cold water over him, and when he came to, saw him safely out of the churchyard, locked the gate, and departed on their different ways. "Well, Oliver," said Sowerberry, as they walked home, "how do you like it?" "Pretty well, thank you, sir," replied Oliver, with considerable hesitation. "Not very much, sir." "Ah, you'll get used to it in time, Oliver," said Sowerberry. "Nothing when you are used to it, my boy." Oliver wondered, in his own mind, whether it had taken a very long time to get Mr. Sowerberry used to it. But he thought it better not to ask the question, and walked back to the shop, thinking over all he had seen and heard. Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.